Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network for this Tuesday, the 2nd of July. Ours Against Hate campaign was launched in Milwaukee at the end of June. It is a worldwide anti-hatred campaign that was started earlier and globally by two people in the U.S. State Department. Hannah Rosenthal, who was the special envoy to combat anti-Semitism, and Farah Pandeeth, who was the special representative to Muslim communities. Now, the campaign is in America. It is called Hours Against Hate, and it's asking you to give 1 hour or more of your time to someone who doesn't look like you, pray like you, live like you, or love like you. The project was one that went viral internationally in 2011. Hannah Rosenthal is the CEO and president of the Milwaukee Jewish Federation. She was special envoy to monitor and combat anti-Semitism for the U.S. State Department, executive director of the Chicago Foundation for Women, the Jewish Council for Public Affairs, and the Wisconsin Women's Council. She represents the at-large community on the U.S. National Commission for the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, UNESCO, and also on the Committee on Holocaust Denial and State-Sponsored Anti-Semitism of the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Hannah during the course of this hour. So if you would like to join us and join the campaign or hear more about the campaign or tell your own tales of fighting against hatred, we'd like to hear them this hour of the show. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page, if you would like to use that, is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Hannah, thank you very much for being with us. Hello.
Hello, my pleasure.
So this is a program that really started globally and now is going locally. Is it fair to say it went that way?
Well, that's really fair. It started when Farah and I were in the State Department. And when you're in the State Department, federal rules are the only country you can't deal with is your own, the United States. So when we launched this, it was done on the international stage, but couldn't in the United States. And so now that I'm not in the State Department anymore, I was able to do that here from Milwaukee.
And you just launched it just a little while ago,
That's
right?
That's right, just a couple weeks ago.
Mm-hmm. Let's start with your own story, because when you look at what has happened in your lifetime and your father's lifetime and extended generations, it's no wonder that you're doing the kind of work that you're doing and on the level that you're doing that. It was 74 years ago, I believe, that your father was arrested by the Nazis. What happened?
Well, my father was a rabbi in Mannheim, Germany, young rabbi, and on Kristallnacht, November 9th, 1938, which many people think is the unofficial beginning of the Holocaust. Synagogues and Jewish businesses were burned and destroyed, as was my father's. So his synagogue was burned to the ground, and he was arrested and sent to Buchenwald concentration camp. And by the way, was saved and got out of the camp by the intervention of a Lutheran pastor from Heidelberg, Germany, Pastor Hermann Moss, who I, when I was 10 years old, was lucky enough to get to meet. So my strong passion for social justice and fighting hatred really comes to me very naturally. And my approach, which is really to reach across, you know, lines of normal division to try and fight that hatred, also comes to me very naturally because of my father's story.
And your father was the only of your relatives who was able to escape.
That is right. Pastor Moss got him out of Germany, and thankfully he did. I'm sitting here today because of that, but no one else in his family survived.
Mm. So you continue their stories in your heart and in your words. Are there still, it's hard to believe, and maybe I'm just being naive here, Hannah, but are there still countries in the world who refuse to teach about the Holocaust?
Oh, my gosh, yes. Not only are there countries that refuse to teach about it, there are countries that deny it ever happened. And there are countries that are revising history to make their personal history different rather than being collaborators. You know, they're rewriting history. I mean, a perfect example out of the Middle East is that there are people and there are governments and there are educational systems that not only refuse to teach about the Holocaust, but actually teach the old czarist forgery, The Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which was one of Adolf Hitler's favorite books, to prove that, you know, this ridiculous conspiracy theory that Jews were trying to take over the world. And this book is taught as a textbook in Saudi Arabia. When I was in Jordan talking about the fact that Holocaust isn't being taught there, and I met with the Minister of Education in Jordan, and I said, how can you be teaching your students and preparing them for life in this, you know, century without talking about perhaps the biggest horrible story that happened in the last century? And his answers were, not sure it happened. This is the Minister of Education in Jordan. So, Whoa. Oh yes, this is, it's alive and well and remarkable in its potency. I will say there's some countries in Europe that were, you know, have their own troubling history during the Holocaust that now are trying to revise how history records what they did or didn't do. And you're seeing a lot of that happening, particularly in Hungary right now, where the actual curriculum is changing the way people are reporting about their leader, Horthy, rather than being a collaborator with the Nazis, is now a hero, and actually statues are being put up all over the country. It's very troubling and demands a lot of attention.
Let's go back to the Minister of Education. Unbelievable that a person who believes that way can have such a job. How can anybody exist in this world with all of the evidence and all of the firsthand accounts, although people certainly are dying off now, but how can you deny something that so many people saw, and we have pictures and world wars were fought over, you know, the horrendous policies? How can you deny things like that and get away with it?
Well, Kathleen, I don't have an answer to that. They get away with it because they have the backing of their government, or if they're at an institution, the backing of their institution. If they promulgate a lie that Jews are, you know, part of a world conspiracy, or that we're responsible for the killing of their God, or we're responsible for all the evil in the world, then they also will believe that Jews have made this up. And it's not like they are studying it in their schools. So while you and I may know that you can log on to a computer and get information that a government doesn't want you to get, if you are taught that it was a lie, that's what they're going to believe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just unbelievable. I understand it happens, but it certainly is hard to understand. Well, let's talk about hate in the world, because there still are so many divisions, and there are people who hate people still who are a different color, or sexual orientation, or religion, or whatever. What are the origins of all of that? What's in it for people to hate somebody?
I don't know the answer to that. If I did, I think, and if you and I could figure that out, we'd be Nobel Peace Prize winners. There is something that happens. I tend to look at the world as two kinds of people. The people who shine the light on themselves for doing good things, or people who shine the light on themselves by casting shadows on others.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, the latter, there are a lot of people like that. And so to the extent that you, out of fear or out of, you know, misinformation and a bad educational system, religious teachings, or who knows what, are taught bad things about people, to some people, it makes them feel better about themselves, or that they're somehow a notch higher. And the world's full of that, whether it's religious bigotry, racial bigotry, ethnic, you know, we don't need to look very far to see it evidenced, particularly when it escalates to violence. But, you know, you started by asking me the story of my father and the Holocaust. And some people who are survivors of the Holocaust come out, well, those that can retain their sanity, which is a mystery to me how anyone can.
Yes.
those that can come out with a lot of different messages, but the most constant message you will hear from Holocaust survivors, whether they were my father or famous ones like Elie Wiesel, is that what the lesson of the Holocaust is what happens when there's unchecked hatred. Mm-hmm. And if we allow hatred to, you know, rear its ugly head and we don't confront it, there are people around who think, therefore, it's acceptable. And then it grows and grows. And that's what we're seeing, you know, repeatedly in history.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I have spent my life, and so many others have as well, trying to figure out what's the right way to confront that hatred. Do you do it every time you hear a hateful thing said? Do you confront that person? Well, that's a one-on-one, and relationships are really important, and it's important to do. Do you do it by trying to change an educational system so that all different parts of, you know, and education is so fundamental to what future cultures are going to be? Do you do it by ensuring that when people are studying beyond mathematics and the basics, that they're also learning about human interactions and how history is full of unchecked hatred?
Mm-hmm.
That message, that fundamental message, that we will have bad chapters in history repeatedly unless we recognize that we have to check it as soon as we see it, before it grows, before it becomes okay, before governments start adopting it and policies start adopting it, and then we see horrific outcomes.
Yeah. And it's taken, it always takes different forms, doesn't it? I know that you have talked about and written about some of the forms we're seeing today, which happen to be bullying in the United States for people who are a different weight or a different sexual orientation or wear glasses or whatever. I don't want to spend some time talking about that. Or also these hatred against immigrants in Europe. There is a lot of that going on right now, isn't there?
It's really frightening. And one of the ways that I have differentiated when I talk about what I experienced traveling the world as the special envoy for the State Department and what I experience as an American is that what is happening around the world is a surge of nationalism.
Mm.
And we don't completely, we Americans don't completely understand nationalism because we understand patriotism, support our troops, we're proud to be an American, USA, USA. We understand patriotism. But we have not, and we also recognize that we're a nation of immigrants, other than the native population.
Right.
And so the messages you hear in other countries is, you know, our country is for us and anybody else is not welcome. That kind of nationalism is happening in an uncomfortable degree. And what makes me nervous about what I hear some sentiments being expressed in this country, and it could be because I'm fresh off of, you know, traveling the world stage as the special envoy and seeing such nationalism. But when I hear some of the debate in the immigration debate, it is almost like that nationalism. And we should be very worried about that because our country wouldn't be the strong, unbelievably successful power that we are if it hadn't been for our diversity and welcoming, you know, diverse people into our country. And so some of the language that we're seeing around the immigration debate really makes me nervous that we could be seeing that kind of nationalism, not yet, but it's getting close there, to what we're seeing in other countries. I think, for instance, a country like Lithuania or Ukraine, countries that have long histories of ethnic fights and countries taking them over and, you know, a kind of world history that we don't understand here in our country. When they start talking about Lithuania for Lithuanians only,
right,
and those kind of comments happening, mm-hmm, or you have political parties in Hungary like the Jobbik Party that actually is running on a hatred agenda.
Mm.
hating the Roma, hating the Jews, or the Golden Dawn Party in Greece that is unbelievably popular. I mean, one would think that they would be so marginalized because they run on hatred and, by the way, Holocaust denial. Mm. You have to look at this and say, is there a trend in that nationalism and should we be paying attention to it? And I'm happy to tell you our country is paying attention to it.
So what happens when you, considering your history, and a dramatic one it is, Hannah, when you as a special envoy have confronted some of these ideas and some of these people face to face, it's hard to ignore you and your family history, isn't it? When you confront this, what do you say?
When I was there confronting prime ministers or foreign ministers, I was there as a representative of President Obama and at the time Secretary Clinton. I wasn't there as the daughter of a Holocaust survivor. Whether or not that issue came up, from time to time it did. But that is always present in who I am and the passion with which I brought whatever message I was bringing to different countries. So how do they respond? Well, it depends what I was bringing to their attention. I told you what the Minister of Education of Jordan said to me. We're not sure it happened.
Right.
Well, I looked right back at him and said, shame on you.
Right. Good for you.
When I'm meeting with the foreign minister of Ukraine and his reaction to me, you're not going to believe this one, Kathleen, or your listeners, but and I had a lot of witnesses for this. When the foreign minister of Ukraine said to me, we have belief that Jews kidnapped 25,000 Ukrainian children to steal their organs.
Oh, my gosh.
And I look at them, and I looked him in the eyes, and I said, shame on you. Mm. That's like the modern version of the blood libel accusation from the medieval times. What are you talking about? And he said, well, we did do a study, and there aren't 25,000 children missing. How do you respond to that? Well, I respond by calling him out, by repeating it publicly like I am now, and I repeated it to the higher-ups at the State Department and the White House, and of course, it was discussed with them. They're not saying that publicly anymore. But if that's in the zeitgeist of a country, you can only imagine what other things are there.
Hannah Rosenthal is our guest this hour. We're talking about the Hours Against Hate campaign, which has been global and is now local. It was launched in Milwaukee at the end of June, a worldwide anti-hatred campaign. How do we take on various forms of hatred? As Hannah has said, the number of Holocaust deniers, even including the Minister of Education in Jordan, what a story that is, that those people are increasing in numbers at the same time that people who have survived the Holocaust are declining, which indicates we have a crisis on our hands. But we always have a crisis on our hands where this kind of hatred flourishes. And it takes many forms. What about bullying in this country, which is so widespread, or attitudes against immigration in this country? And certainly we've seen that in Europe. We welcome your phone calls, programs that work to combat hatred and ignorance. And we'll learn more about her campaign, Hours Against Hate. Our phone number, if you would like to join us, is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. You can send us an email message if you would like, and that's talk@WPR.org. And we also have a Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. So we'll be with you momentarily. I am Kathleen Dunn, and this is, we're having our new time period, which started yesterday, 1 to 3, just so you know that, because here we are, so we're here, but we're going to be here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hannah Rosenthal is here now. We're talking about Hours Against Hate campaign and how hate manifests itself and can be confronted all over the world. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. And we go to Alex in Madison, our first caller. Hi, Alex.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I appreciate your program. I appreciate you talking about this. I think that it's a great idea to support an idea of people going out and talking to people who aren't exactly like them. I grew up in a very prejudice and racism-based society. the way that I was brought up, it wasn't necessarily about hatred. You know, I'd have to say, but it was more about lack of empathy with anybody who didn't look like you, didn't worship like you, or anything like that. You know, it manifested through the way that I was taught to think about certain situations. A situation when it came to, you know, women and any kind of struggles that women were going through, it was always a lack of empathizing with that situation. And whenever it came to race, you know, if you're white or the white side of the argument, I would have to say, or the racist side, always trumped any other side. And I just wanted to say that the way that I got over that is I was able to move away, and I was able to, you know, have those discussions with a lot of people. And I met my wife, who is actually from Nigeria, and I was able to immerse myself into another situation that was much more open and understanding.
Thank you, Alex, for your call. Hannah.
Well, you have a wonderful story to tell, and I want to tell you that I met with young people in Lebanon, in Jordan, even in Saudi Arabia, who repeatedly would say, I was raised with certain bigotries. I would like to not inherit the bigotry of my parents, but it's pretty ingrained. But just having them say that and recognize that their upbringing included dismissal of people who were different was a really important first step. What makes me sad is you said you got past it by moving away. And, you know, not everybody can just move away from where they grew up, from the community that raised them and loved them and that they want to give back to. So part of what we were trying to do with Hours Against Hate was appeal to people to not have to move away, to just volunteer an hour or more of their time to virtually walk in someone else's shoes, to reach out and do something with someone who otherwise you would not be spending time with. And, you know, this started as a virtual campaign. It started in 2011 with, and it's kind of a good segue from what you were asking me, Kathleen, about my dad. Mm-hmm. It's one thing when someone named Hannah Rosenthal confronts a world leader on Holocaust denial, because all they're seeing is the child of a Holocaust survivor saying something about the Holocaust. And while that's important, and I bring a lot of passion to that, it was not as potent, it was not as powerful as when Farah Pandith, who is the special representative to Muslim communities, condemned Holocaust denial.
Ah, yes.
And so it became the message is really important, but sometimes to amplify the message or to have it have a greater impact, it matters who the messenger is. And that began when we were at an international conference in Kazakhstan, of all places, a conference on intolerance representing the United States. And before we spoke, we swapped speeches.
Oh.
So Farah, who is the special representative from the U.S. State Department on Muslim engagement, and I, who is the special envoy to combat global anti-Semitism, she spoke out against anti-Semitism, I spoke out against hatred of Muslims, and everyone paid attention.
I would imagine. What a wonderful
idea.
And that
started with walking in someone else's shoes.
Uh-huh. So give us more ideas of how you walk in somebody else's shoes. I mean, what do you do?
Well, first of all, I have to do a plug to oursagainsthate.org,
okay,
which has a list of 100 ways you can do that.
Okay.
But let me just say that at that conference in Kazakhstan, we brought with us six non-governmental organizations of young people from all over the world. And they watched Farah and Hannah switch speeches and said, that's all great, a bunch of diplomats talking at each other. What kind of, you know, really grassroots change can that make? Give us something to do. And that's when Farah and I came back and realized it's not good enough. It's important diplomatically to make those kind of powerful statements and speak on each other's behalf, but we really need it always to have a call to action. And so we started it through Facebook and Twitter. Farah is much younger than me and understood the power of social media. I still don't get it. But we just put it out there. Everyone should volunteer an hour of their time to reach out to someone who doesn't look like them or pray like them or love like them or live like them. And, you know, an hour later, 100 people had responded. I don't
get that. An hour later?
Yeah,
oh, my goodness.
I don't know how that works, but it did. And before we knew it, tens of thousands of young people around the world were tweeting and responding on the Facebook page with ideas. One might have been, I'm straight, and I'm going to volunteer time for the gay pride parade. I'm Christian, and I don't know any Jews. I'm going to go and volunteer to read at a Jewish preschool. There were people who tweeted or put on the Facebook, I'm going to make, you know, thousands of peanut butter and jelly sandwiches for the hungry. Those are people who don't live like me. And so people were creative. And you know what happens when that occurs? A relationship happens. So it isn't just the hour that you're reading a book to young children who are of a different ethnic or religious or racial group. You are starting to build a relationship. And, you know, coming from the State Department, we were in the relationship business. And so it came very naturally for us to talk about it. But what was so powerful were the young people who responded with these great ideas.
Yes.
There's a health clinic down the way, but only Latinos go to that health clinic. I would never go there. I'm going to go volunteer there. Those kind of ideas came forward, and people engaged all over the world.
It's wonderful. It is wonderful. More about that, too, go to our Facebook page, and we have a link to the project that Hannah is talking about, so you can get all of those suggestions. And our Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. We have a ton of phone calls coming in. Let's go to Jan in Stevens Point next. Hi, Jan.
Good morning, or afternoon, I should say. I wanted to thank you for your work you're doing. My mother also was a survivor of the war and spent most of her time from 16 to 21 in a camp. And her mother, while in Prague, allowed Jewish families to cut in front of her in the bread line, and the Germans made her wear a Star of David throughout the war. So,
thank you to your family.
One of the things that can be done, or might be a good suggestion, is sort of like Nelson Mandela did down in South Africa after his election and creating a truth and reconciliation, and doing that maybe on a broader scale.
Well, it's a great idea, and first of all, I really want to thank you for your family. One of the things I got to do as special envoy on this subject was go to Albania. Now, a lot of people don't know much about Albania. It's a little country, but during World War II, it was the only Muslim-majority country in Europe. And Albania saved every single one of its Jews. At the end of the war, there were 10 times as many Jews in Albania as before the war. If you could get there, you were safe. It's really a remarkable story, and I got to go to Albania and thank the Albanians. I tear up now just remembering it. And I remember standing there and looking at the prime minister and saying, I know diplomats aren't supposed to cry. But how often do you get an opportunity to thank people? So thank you, Jan, and your family. But what a message that is. You know, people risk their lives and their families' lives to do the right thing and save people. There weren't enough of them, but there were a lot of them. And they need recognition, and I think the light needs to be shone on them, because in the God forbids that anything as horrific as that could ever happen, and to a lesser degree in our own communities, you need to know that people do choose the right thing. They do stand up and confront the hatred. They do stand up and stop the bullying, and in some cases stand up and demand truth and reconciliation. And Mandela is a great example of how he did it. He was a very powerful symbol. He still is a very powerful symbol of what can happen in reconciliation. It's not an easy thing to do. It's not an easy thing to do at all.
And it is one of those, when you were telling that story, what you just told me will stay with me for my lifetime. When I think about what Mandela did, that enters you in a very deep way. You think about him, and you think about him forever because it's such a moment of teaching all of us, isn't it? When you rise above all of that hatred and pettiness and horrible behavior that can lead to really harming people, you realize it's a much better way to go. And I think you're right. We do need to be reminded of that. Let's talk about Albania every day and how they were. You know, that's a great thing to think about.
It sure is. And, you know, you can understand. And I would say to people who survived the war and were put through unimaginable torture and pain, mm-hmm. that they have every right to be bitter. And they have every right to close off the rest of the world and say, where were you? But they don't. They don't. They come out and say, I'm committed to making sure never again has meaning, and I'm going to do my little part to make sure that that's, you know, that doesn't happen again. And I think that's another part of the story, that the lesson is that the Holocaust happened because of unchecked hatred, and modern day happens because people stood up to it. And so thanks to Ian, and thanks, of course, to Mandela, but people who on much lesser profound scales are standing up and doing the right thing. It moves us all, and students need to be learning those lessons, because it can seem overwhelming when you're being bullied or when you're seeing hatred rear its head. And we don't have to look very far.
No, we don't. We're about
to hit the anniversary of the Oak Creek shootings.
Yes.
We don't have to look very far to realize that there are people who want to do others harm. And we have to check that hatred if it's on a website, if it's in the public square at all, if you hear it from a pulpit, if you hear it from any kind of world leader who is trying to stoke hatred and fear. It's unacceptable and has to be called out.
Thank you so much for your call. I'm sure you're familiar with the work that Pardeep Kalika has been doing. He's going to join us on the anniversary of that horrendous massacre with this former white supremacist who wanted to meet with him, who was really struck by what happened. And the two of them have formed Serve to Unite, this organization that is trying to bring groups of people who normally would hate each other together all over the world and realize there's another way. And when you think about somebody doing that who lost his father less than a year ago in that kind of horror, again, it gives you pause. You have to pay attention to what he says. It's such an important story. His life is so meaningful in how it touches other people now.
It's really true, and I want to say that they were there when we launched the Hours Against Hate campaign.
Oh, were they really?
Oh, yes.
Oh, the story goes on and on.
And Serve to Unite totally gets it, and we look forward to working very closely with them.
Mm. Mary Lou in Richland Center, hi. Mary Lou, are you there? I'm sorry, Mary Lou, I got to press that. Forgive me, Mary Lou, I got the wrong button. I got no button. There we go. Go ahead.
You buttoned me.
I'm sorry.
First, I want to thank you for what you're doing and compliment you, because I know in my adult life, I have had a lot of opportunity to travel the world. Professionally, I work mostly with colleagues who are from a different country. They don't speak the same language that I do. They don't believe the way I do. And because of these opportunities, my life is so enriched and so filled with joy. And I've had the opportunity to realize relationships are like a big smorgasbord, mm-hmm. and life is better when you have the chance to become friends with people who are different than you. But at the same time, I also have a frustration with our own country and our government, and I need to criticize and chastise our government, because we too are guilty of Holocaust denial, and that is the Armenian Holocaust. You know, our government does not want to acknowledge or have anything about the Armenian Holocaust taught in our schools, because we have great diplomatic relations with Turkey and we don't want to cause trouble. And yet, you know, nearly 2 million Armenians were put into death camps, death marches, slaughtered in 1915 and 1916. And our country kind of sweeps that under the carpet. It's the Holocaust we don't talk about.
It's a terrible tragedy. I want to tell you a story, Mary Lou. When I was in Azerbaijan, and actually Farah and I were there promoting the Hours Against Hate campaign, and it's remarkable to watch young people get their ideas. You know, oh, I'm going to go and do this, and I'm going to go to the border and help this group, and I'm going to go into a preschool, and I'm going to read, and I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. And one kid said, I'm willing to do anything to stop hatred, but don't ask me to do anything for the Armenians. And we were just floored and said, did you hear what you just said? And, you know, the group ended up really putting pressure on that kid. How can you say that? I mean, that only happened 3 times in all of the tens of thousands of young people that we met with. But, oh, how horrible. And so when you bring up the Armenian genocide and people who, want to dismiss it, say it wasn't a genocide or diplomatically ignore it, you know, shame on everybody who does that.
Thank you, Mary Lou, for your call. Susan in Madison, hi.
Did you say Susan?
Yes, I did. Hi, Susan.
Hi. Hi, Hannah.
Hi, Susan.
I wanted to go back to Jordan and the Minister of Education there and ask about the potential influence of Queen Rania of Jordan, who is also a UNICEF envoy for children. And as you may know, Hannah has written a book for children on tolerance called The Sandwich Swap. Are you familiar with that?
I'm not familiar with The Sandwich Swap.
I bought it for my 5-year-old granddaughter on the UNICEF website for Christmas. My question is, what sort of influence might she, as a Western-educated, sophisticated woman, even though she's a queen and married to a king, have in public policy? That in particular, and in general, can or are women a moderating force to some of the hatred that you're talking about?
Oh, my, I wish we had a whole hour to talk about that. First of all, about Jordan, I want to say something before I start an international incident here. The Minister of Education, once confronted on this, is no longer the Minister of Education.
All right.
Now, I'd like to be able to say connect the dots, and I spoke out, and then he lost his job. I can't make that claim, but he is no longer the Minister of Education. What the Queen does when she speaks out, and she speaks out on feminism, has a terrific impact in Jordan. The king and queen are very beloved there. You don't go anywhere without, you know, their photo, and they have their hands full right now. The whole region is a bit on fire, so I wish them well. But her, the queen's outreach through UNICEF and her message of tolerance is one that can only help. And because she's Western educated, and by the way, most of the leaders in the Middle East are Western educated, which is sometimes, you know, so amazing. I want to speak to, like, going to Saudi Arabia. And I met with a group of women in Saudi Arabia. I had to meet them at a women's mall. Everything is completely separate there.
Oh, my.
And one of the women had just the day before come back. She had just graduated from Smith College. And so I'm familiar with the education she would have gotten. Good, solid women empowerment messages at Smith College, one of the few women's colleges. I went down the road at Mount Holyoke College. And this is just a lovely woman, brilliant, bright. And when we went to leave, put on her abaya and covered her face, and everyone walked out. And that disconnect for me was so profound. Mm-hmm. How do you, first of all, how, you know, to make yourself invisible in a country is one thing, but to come out of Western, particularly American education, where and a schooling where you are told of your worth and encouraged to, you know, blow your own horn and make social change, to go back to a country that is so repressive to women, still haunts me, and I still can't get my head around it. Mm. I think the power of women is about to be ignited. in that part of the world. I think it's only a matter of time, and I have to think, I have to, or I couldn't get up in the morning, think that the fundamental message of equality and tolerance and fighting against hatred and dismissal and bullying, etc., will ultimately be forged by women leaders and by men who get the power of women leaders.
We had a guest last week speaking specifically in reference to Saudi Arabia who said there's really no country in the Middle East that's immune from revolution. And he was mentioning Saudi Arabia specifically. You don't think that could happen, but maybe it can, right?
Well, there you can only imagine, given what all of their neighborhood is going through right now, that they're plenty nervous. You know how the women have organized in Saudi Arabia, and how do they organize to show their protest? They get in a car and drive, because women are forbidden from driving. And then they get arrested, and then it's on television. And so an act of defiance, like driving your car in Saudi Arabia, has potency. Yeah. It has power. And I think it's only a matter of time until they're driving change. Right to all.
Driving change. Gotcha. Yeah. Thanks. Yeah. Hannah Rosenthal is our guest. Thank you, Susan, for your call. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. We're talking about the Hours Against Hate campaign, which is essentially walk a mile in somebody else's shoes. And there are suggestions on how to do that on their website. And you can also go to our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. You may want to leave your own suggestions there, too, so it can spread. The suggestions are there on the campaign, Hours Against Hate, and then we'd like to hear some from you as well. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we go next to Rich in Rhinelander. Hi, Rich.
Hi. I like what you're talking about today. A long time ago, I read an essay, I think it was in a women's journal, a small journal, about a community event they called Walk with the One You Love. And the whole idea was in a community to mix it up by gathering together for, I guess, just gathering together in general fundraising. But I could see something like that being linked to service education for kids in junior and in middle school and high school. And the whole idea would be to not identify the walk as anything more than people going to work on something in the community and walking together. I just Googled walk with the one you love, and if you do that, what you get is how to walk away from the one you love and how to walk away unrequited love.
Oh.
So I don't think I'm going to have any luck finding the article that I read a long time ago. But that's the idea of it, is to choose the person you're least likely to appear in public with or walk with and make it a point as a community event to get to work on some mutual concern or issue.
Oh, I like that, Rich.
Rich, that's a great idea. You know, I'm reminded, given a recent Supreme Court decision and the subsequent community conversation about the Voting Rights Act, and how that monumental piece of civil rights legislation started with walks.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something very powerful about walking and taking a step together, particularly in diversity. I want to tell you a story. Now, I really wanted to do this show, Kathleen, to promote that we need to be confronting hatred in this country and in our own communities here. But I do want to tell you a story about the third largest city in Sweden is a city called Malmo. And the very small Jewish community there is half as big as it was a few years ago, because half of them have left because of pretty profound anti-Semitism.
Oh.
And when I went there to speak out against the anti-Semitism and to confront the mayor there, who was espousing so much of it, I met with Muslim leaders and Roma leaders and some of the people who were active in the Lutheran church there. And their solution to fighting back against the hatred that was happening was to have what they call a kippah walk. Now, a kippah or a yarmulke is what Jews wear to show reverence for God, and it's a visible symbol, right, that somebody's Jewish. Well, the Roma and the Lutherans and the Muslims put on a kippah and walked with the rabbi to and from the synagogue to protect him, but also to show diversity in walking and show, you know, to speak out and walk against the intolerance that one segment of the community was experiencing. So walking together is a very powerful symbol, and it's a great, easy way to take, literally, to take steps to fight against intolerance. So I'll look for that article too, Rich.
Well, yeah, wonderful. Thanks. And we'll post it if everybody finds it. Hannah, I think we need to do just an hour with my travels with Hannah. You've really been to places that people haven't been.
Well, I'm the luckiest person you know because I had this fabulous opportunity, and I thank the president every day for giving me that opportunity. My kids used to say to me, you know, doesn't it depress you to go around the world and see such anti-Semitism? And my answer always was, well, no, because I get to do something about it. And I think that when we get overwhelmed by seeing the kind of hatred that happens on the world stage or in our own communities, we can easily become paralyzed, easily become overwhelmed, and not know what to do. And the beauty of saying, I'm going to devote an hour of my time, is breaking what can be an overwhelming task into a very doable part.
Yes, it is.
And that's why the power of Hours Against Hate is everybody can devote an hour. All have at least an hour of our time.
We sure do. And then some. Rich, thanks for the call. Mike in Appleton, hi.
Yes. I think there's a real simple test that white people in this state, particularly with all the legislation passed in the recent years to seemingly aggravate bigotry and racism, can try on themselves. And that is this. As a white person, you've been charged with a battery. You're going to have a jury trial. You walk into the court with your attorney. The judge is black. The DA is black. The jury is all black. And the victim is black. Do you feel uncomfortable? Do you think you're going to get a fair trial? That's evaluation of your own, of whether or not you may be a bigot. And I mentioned before on this show about a book is now going to be taught this fall at Harvard and one of my friends in Department of Psychology. It's called The Perfect Nazi. Read it. It can happen to anybody. And it's reflection upon your own values and the way you were growing up. And it helps you to understand whether or not you could be a bigot.
Thank you, Mike. Are you familiar with that book, Hannah?
I'm not, but I just wrote it down to make sure I go out and get it.
Right.
I think we all have to look at our own demons. I don't think any of us, no matter how much time and energy we put into, you know, fighting bigotry, we have to face the fact that we are the product of our educational system, our religious upbringing, and we've got our own personal demons to deal with. There's nobody who... I don't know of a single soul that doesn't have to wrestle with that.
Thanks, Mike. One more call, running short on time. Gail in Fish Creek. Hi, Gail.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My aunt and uncle, back in the early 80s, my uncle had to go to Saudi Arabia for business and live there for like 2 years, and my aunt had to go with. And they had to be in a regular villa. They couldn't be in the American compound where they can do all their normal things that Americans do and women can dress the way they want to and everything. She had to be in the garb that, you know, the cover-up and everything. She couldn't hide in another room in her own home if any of these Saudi Arabian businessmen came to their home to visit, you know, to do something with my uncle. She had to make her presence known, so she had to do their complete custom in her home. And because it would have been rude if she didn't come down. And it all seemed so that it was just for intimidation to constantly keep putting the feminine of our species in its place, which is an underling, which is not even having an identity. So us as a family, we were experiencing this. And all the women, all my relatives and all, we just take it upon ourselves to say, to be as independent you can and go for every independence that you can for women and the girls, and to know their right to even fundamentally have control over their reproductive rights is so important that that, in a way, helps the women that are in these other situations in these other countries.
Thank you, Gail, so much for the call.
Amen.
Hannah, we're out of time. Give us the website again.
OursAgainstHateOneWord.org.
All right. Thank you. You go get them. I know you'll continue to do so. Thanks, Hannah. It was a great hour. We'll talk to you again. Hannah Rosenthal, CEO, President of the Milwaukee Jewish Federation, former Special Envoy to monitor and combat anti-Semitism for the U.S. Department of State. We thank her for being with us. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and KP Whaley for producing this program. Really good hour tomorrow at 2 o'clock. This is one gorgeous book, meaningful book. George Packer, author of The Unwinding, an Inner History of the New America. So join us for that tomorrow at 2. And tell everybody we've moved 1 to 3 instead of 9 to 11. Thanks for listening. Great conversations ahead on the Ideas Network.